Let me lower it down to the front of the speaker.
I couldn't. Okay, just waiting for the signal. Okay, we're on?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, hi everybody. And please forgive me for not using the podium. I just felt it would be easier for me to be down with the people, as we say. And the topic that I'm going to be talking about is a topic that unfortunately is a very, very painful topic. It's a very emotional topic. The issue of the halachos concerning end-of-life treatments. Many people face this with elderly parents. Baruch Hashem, on one hand, medical science has extended many people's lives. On the other hand, sometimes people, through that extension, live with a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And the difficulties that we have, both emotionally and halakhically, is when do you kind of say, I have to keep people alive no matter what? And when do you say, you know, if the person's going to suffer, perhaps I don't need to be as aggressive as I otherwise would be. You know, in all ethical questions, certainly in halacha as well, it's relatively easy to identify the values. You know, I could say everybody's in favor of apple pie and baseball and patriotism, but the problem of ethical decision making is not so much in identifying the values, but in prioritizing and assessing the value of the values when they are in conflict and contradiction. So in this particular context, it's easy to say there's a mitzvah to keep people alive and there's a mitzvah to alleviate their pain. I'm in favor of alleviating pain and I'm in favor of giving people life. Well, gesundheit, that's a wonderful thing. But what happens if by keeping people alive you're prolonging their pain? Or conversely, by alleviating their pain, you're going to be shortening their lives. That's where things get very murky and things get very difficult. Now, in the United States for around the past, it's been a long time already, for more than 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, there has been the recognition of what is called a constitutional right to die. For those of you that are lawyers or have legal background, this is grounded in the same so-called right to privacy that is the basis of Roe versus Wade, abortion. And that is, a person that is competent has the absolute right to decline any type of medical treatment that will keep them alive. That includes hydration and nutrition. You have the right to starve yourself to death. And if you are in a coma and unable to make that decision, your next of kin will be able to make, I'm talking about legally now, will be able to make that decision based on what they think, not what they would want per se, but it's based on what they think you would want. Although that's an extremely murky mental operation. In other words, theoretically, I'm not asking what I would want, I'm asking what do I think they would want. Now is that really, okay, but putting aside that, Now, this was established in a United States Supreme Court opinion called Cruzan. Nancy Cruzan was a woman in a coma, and her parents petitioned the courts of Missouri to disconnect her feeding tube. And the Supreme Court of the United States basically said that the Constitution requires that she has the right to decline that treatment, and the next of kin could make the decision based on what they thought she would want. This is called in constitutional law the right to die. Now, what's interesting is that the next scenario, I'm giving you a little legal background so you'll understand the halacha in context, is, well, if there's a constitutional right, and by the way, again, I apologize, I am, besides being a rabbi, I'm a lawyer by training, so if I talk a little legalistically, I hope you'll be able to follow, but I hope you do understand the significance of something being a constitutional right. When something is a right that is grounded in the United States Constitution, that means a state is not allowed to be stricter. A state cannot protect life if there's a constitutional right to die. In fact, a recent example of the strength of a constitutional right, it's not our topic, is the very unfortunate Supreme Court opinion saying there is a constitutional right to homosexual marriage. By calling it a constitutional right, that means that even if a majority of the voters in all 50 states would want to prohibit it, they would not be allowed to do it. It is in the Constitution. By the same token, Cruzan established a constitutional right to die by declining medical treatment, and the Supreme Court refused to distinguish between medical treatment like surgery, CPR, respirators, and hydration and nutrition. They considered feeding, tube feeding, to be the same as any other medical treatment in which you have a constitutional right to decline. So the next thing the Supreme Court had to deal with is, well, if I have a constitutional right to starve myself, and I have a constitutional right to have respirators shut off and feeding tubes withdrawn, why shouldn't I have a constitutional right to enlist the assistance of a physician in committing suicide? Physician-assisted suicide. Now, yes, it is true that withdrawal of medical assistance is a passive thing, you're not providing, versus assisted suicide, which is an active thing. But after all, either way, the patient's going to die. So if the patient has a constitutional right to have all medical treatment discontinued, even if it started, then there ought to be a constitutional right to assisted suicide. The Supreme Court, with some dissents, refused to go that far. The Supreme Court said a state may permit assisted suicide, but it doesn't have to permit it. And that's why in some states like Washington and Oregon, there is indeed physician-assisted suicide, as there is in the Netherlands and in some Scandinavian countries, but in many, many states that is still considered to be a crime. Obviously, suicide is also a crime, but it's a non-prosecutable crime, because if you're dead, only God can be your judge. Attempted suicide is a crime. You can go to jail for trying to kill yourself. And the doctor, like Dr. Kevorkian, could be prosecuted for assisting, facilitating a suicide. So this is kind of the background in American law. Now let me point out that our neighbor to the north, the great nation of Canada, and of course I have great affection for Canada. My brother lives in Toronto, and in addition, Prime Minister Stephen Harper is one of the great friends of Eretz Yisrael throughout the world, so he deserves much, much credit, and there's no doubt that Hashem will give him, as a righteous Gentile, a generous portion in the world to come. But it's interesting that the Canadian Supreme Court recently took the position that there is a constitutional right to have a physician help me commit suicide, and a province would not be able to prohibit it. So it's a very interesting machloka, it's very rare, so to speak, between the Supreme Court of Canada and the Supreme Court of the United States regarding the constitutionality of physician-assisted suicide. But be it as it may, even if the Supreme Court said there is no constitutional right to assisted suicide, they did leave it to the states to legitimate, and there is an active movement throughout the United States for the legalization of assisted suicide in various ways and the like. Now, let me just point out a few ideas here, meaning essentially what is emerging in society is if people want to die, we should let them die, and not only let them die, but we should help them die. And if they're not competent to make the decision, we're going to make the decision for them. There are a lot of things, even before we get to the nitty-gritty of halacha, that is very frightening, very scary about this development. First of all, let me point out that some studies have shown that many of the suicides or attempted suicides or assisted suicides were actually the result of treatable depression. Somebody has a bad day, they make certain decisions. Those decisions are irrevocable once they're carried out, so to speak. But in fact, the depression could have been treated. A lot of it is through treatable depression, and that's a very serious issue. Number two, surveys have shown that although assisted suicide is a very, very popular, it is supported by many people in the general public, the reason why people support it is because they have a tremendous fear of severe pain in the end of life. And they feel they want the option of being able to take their lives and have someone help them do so in a gentle way without using a gun. Obviously, people can always commit suicide, but you know, to have it in a way that would be non-violent and non or less traumatic. And their fear is pain management. And I have to say that unfortunately, for many, many years, effective pain management was a very neglected part of Western medicine. A lot of times, the medical community took the position that severe pain was psychological or psychosomatic, it's all in your head, just get over it. As many of you might know, historically, doctors were very reluctant to allow end-of-life people access to morphine because they said, I don't want them to become addicted, even though one only has 2 weeks of life left. But thank God, one of the things that has happened over the past maybe 20 years as well is that pain management has become a very, very well-regarded and well-developed specialty in American medicine. Patients are given morphine drips, and by the way, it's been shown that when a patient is in control of their pain relief medication, they do not abuse it, and in fact, they may use less than a doctor might prescribe. But nevertheless, it is a way to overcome this. We have things like hypnosis, biofeedback, imaging. We have various alternative medicine. And the point that one needs to understand is that the despondency and the hopelessness that people feel in end stages can in fact be overcome to some degree by appropriate pain relief, both in terms of medicine and in terms of alternatives to medicine as well. And in a way, instead of people saying, I'm going to suffer so much, I'd rather die, our responsibility should be to help them over the suffering so they'll want to live and the like. So one problem with the Right to Die movement is, number one, that some of the push comes from treatable depression. Number two, some of it comes because proper pain relief options are not being offered. Number three, there's a very real danger that the right to die gets turned into the obligation to get out of the way. I'm sorry, Ken? Yeah, there's a very real concern that the right to die may turn into the obligation to get out of the way. What do I mean by that? The premise of the right to die is the notion of autonomy. But it actually turns into the idea that autonomy only works in one direction. If you want to discontinue, sure, you have the right to make that decision. But you will find increasingly that when people want aggressive treatment to prolong life, there will be strong voices in the medical community and in the insurance community that will discourage them. This is like the old elections in the Soviet Union. You have the right to vote, but there's only one candidate. You have the right to die, but you may not have the right to live. In fact, legally, this is so fascinating. In the early years of litigation on these questions, going back to the 1970s. The typical scenario was the patient or the patient's family wanted to discontinue life support, and the doctors and the hospitals were fighting to keep people alive, and the courts developed that the patients have these rights. Today, you still have those cases, of course, but today you actually have cases where the patient and the patient's family want to continue, and it's the doctors and the hospitals that are claiming it is futile and useless, and they are becoming advocates of death. And Obamacare is not helping that at all, because indeed, again, I don't want to exaggerate, but you know, the specter of the death panels and the like, to some degree, again, it's been exaggerated, but there's a certain reality as scarce resources are being rationed. And it is very, very true that a huge proportion of the healthcare budget goes to people in the last week of life, like one third, and there's a great, great pressure that people shouldn't use up that money. Let's use that money for other things. So the right to die is not necessarily a right anymore. It almost becomes an obligation. The former governor of Colorado, Richard Lamb, who was a conservative in the 1980s, this is the height of the Reagan administration, when everything was based on cost-benefit, he once suggested in a speech that a person who is over 70 years old, on the average, takes more from the world than he gives to the world. So on a cost-benefit, zero-based budgeting, on a cost-benefit basis, such people ought not to exist. Now, of course, I'm not calling for their euthanasia, but they ought to kind of walk into the forest and disappear because they are taking more from the world than they are giving. Of course, that became very controversial, etc., and he backtracked, but this is what he said. So, even from a secular standpoint, before I even get into Jewish teachings, the right to die movement is very problematical. It ignores the fact that this comes from treatable depression. It ignores the possibility of pain relief to give a person the strength to be able to deal with this problem. It turns into, instead of recognizing autonomy, it turns into putting pressure on people who may want to live, but they now feel they're a burden. So you have to understand, once an option gets on the table, there's a certain pressure to exercise it. When suicide was not a legitimate option, then generally speaking, it wouldn't be considered. But if the elderly parent that is very burdensome and difficult finds as a Father's Day gift a copy of Derek Humphrey's Final Exit book, yeah. Here, Dad, a present to consider. You know, there's a certain pressure there. So there are a lot of problems here. Now, how does halacha deal? Now, again, I want to point out I'm dealing with two different issues here. I'm going to be dealing with the general rule of what medical treatment must we give to people in end-of-life situations, and then I'll also deal with the suicide. These are indeed two different types of questions, but they're premised on this common idea of a right to die that secular society has recognized. Yes, sir?
Now, I'm a geriatric psychiatrist in Tucson, Arizona, and would like to add to the depression scenario, one of which a person has mild or some component of dementia, whether it be Alzheimer's or otherwise, are doing fairly well until they get a urine infection or they're put on some medication that causes a delirium, so an acute change. They go to the hospital where no one knows them. They say your loved one has severe advanced dementia, and they put them on morphine, and within a week it's too late.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very, very good point, and I'm glad to hear an observation from a physician in the field who sees this firsthand. You know, I just want to point out, again, and I don't at all minimize the reality of pain. Pain is a reality, but it's a reality that, to a surprising degree, can be dealt with in many cases and can be managed, maybe not in every case, but in many, many cases, much better than we're doing it. And I also want to point out, too, that there's a certain fallacy of youth here. In other words, let's say you're a young man. I'm not young myself anymore, but let's say a person's a young man. You're walking by, and you see, you know, a 90-year-old man that seems to have difficulty walking and difficulty in elimination and all sorts of problems. And what goes through your mind might be, if I'd have to be like that, I'd rather be dead. But that's not necessarily what's going through their mind. And even Alzheimer's, as devastating and as absolutely tragic as Alzheimer's is, we don't always have a sense of how much the patient might be suffering, at least in some stages. I mean, this patient might have a fair level of satisfaction with the limitations within their lives. And there is a subtle difficulty here in kind of taking myself with my healthy mind and my healthy body and looking at a difficult situation and saying they would rather be dead, when that's not necessarily what they truly want. So when you're dealing with substituted decision making, or you're dealing with living wills that were executed years and years and years before the debilitating condition, they may not reflect the reality of the person when they're in that situation. This is a very difficult issue. This is the issue of the living will that you execute at 25 may not be reflective of your true wishes when you're 70, 75, 80, 90, whatever it would be. So these are all, I think, even from a secular standpoint, these are concerns that have to be taken very, very seriously. So the halakhic principles, I think, are fairly straightforward, but as always, there'll be difficulties in the application. There is nothing in Jewish law or life, for that matter, that is totally simple. Sorry, that's just the way it is. God wants us to struggle and try to figure out these things. But the principles themselves are fairly clear. Principle number one is Judaism is a fairly high-tech religion, meaning to say Judaism does believe in utilizing even advanced technology to keep people alive to whatever degree that is possible. Now you might say, well, that's an obvious point. Why am I making that point? Well, I'm making that point because there are religious traditions that actually believe that aggressive medical intervention is a contravention of the divine. Christian Science, for example, actually believes it is spiritually improper to seek medical intervention. Because if God made you sick, only God can heal you, and by trying to alleviate illness in a human way, in a technological way, you are interfering with the divine. Suffice it to say that Judaism absolutely rejects that position. Otherwise we wouldn't have so many Jewish doctors. And this is based on the verse in Exodus, that if somebody hurts somebody else, so I have to pay his medical expenses, right? Rapo yirapeh. The Talmud remarks, from here we see that a physician is permitted to practice medicine that is called a divine license. Now obviously, God is the source of healing. God is the source of refuah. But God requires that in addition to prayer, Torah study, charity, good deeds, all of which are vitally important. In fact, there's even some medical literature, at least anecdotal studies, that indicate that prayer has therapeutic efficacy, even if the patient does not know that people are praying for him. That we can actually show that if I'm davening for the chola, it has a certain effect. But in addition, God requires that we use naturalistic means. Not only is the doctor allowed to practice medicine, but the patient has an obligation to seek responsible medical care. Now, I'm not going to address the issue of conventional medicine versus alternative medicine. Halacha is kind of agnostic on that. Halacha basically says, if it works, use it. If it doesn't work, don't use it. And halacha is not taking a position. That is a scientific and medical question. But nevertheless, halacha does require that just as God gives us sustenance, but we have to work, so too, God gives us healing and health, but we have to seek medical intervention. This is very important. So principle number one is, we are not Christian Scientists. If you didn't know that. We are Jews, and Judaism starts off with a different theological premise. The way I might describe it is that faith in God is not passive or quiescent, But faith in God must be coupled with human intervention and human initiative. That is principle number one. Yeah. Another physician?
Right.
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
Most physicians will not go in for extraordinary care.
Okay. Okay, well, that's interesting. So I think I may address that as I continue. Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting question. I guess they know how difficult the road is. Yeah, yeah. Principle number two is the principle of pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is simply the Hebrew term for saving a life, and the Torah requires that every moment of life is so significant that even if we desecrate the Shabbat or the Yom Kippur or the Kashrus laws to save, even if our intervention will only prolong life for 1 second, for 1 minute, it is worthwhile. That's called pikuach nefesh. Principle number three, which is really a corollary, is that the value of life is not necessarily a function of quality of life. That even if a life is seemingly, again, I will qualify this, but seemingly without quality, the person is in a permanent coma, the person is not able to communicate, the person is not able to accomplish, it is the sustaining of life itself that is considered to be of value. Now, of course, we can stop here and ask, by what theory can that be so? What use is a life of a person in a coma, a person paralyzed, a person unable to talk, unable to love, perhaps unable to think? Why is there a mitzvah to keep a life alive when there is seemingly no quality? And here, we do have to move to a more mystical idea that our reality is not our body and not our physical selves. Our reality is the spiritual essence that is the godly soul. And souls come to earth for many, many purposes. And sometimes the purpose of a soul is not for what it actually accomplishes in the world, but for the transformative effect it has on others. That if I can learn to relate to this person with respect, with dignity, and with love, that elevates that soul and gives that soul access to the heavenly worlds that it would otherwise not have. You know, in my own family, a relative of mine had a 4-year-old child who tragically died of leukemia. And the child never had a bar mitzvah, obviously. Many, many commandments the child never kept. And you might wonder, what's the purpose of that child's life? Would it have been better if that child was not born? And yet, those of you that have experience with this know that when there is someone sick, particularly a child, how many thousands of people are saying tehillim? How many people give charity? How many people devoted extra Torah study and good deeds? And when this 4-year-old child comes to heaven, and the 4-year-old child must respond, as all of us will have to respond, hopefully after 120 years, what did you accomplish in your life? That child can respond with the thousands of people that did mitzvot because of this child. His life may have made more of a difference than countless people who lived full term. So it's really a Western idea that the value of my life is a function of my productivity, my power, my ability. Souls have different missions, and sometimes there are passive missions in life in terms of transforming others. And therefore, it is very, very true that every soul has a purpose and a sojourn in this earth, even if it is not productive or meaningful in a conventional way. The way the late Rabbi, Chief Rabbi of England, Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz, some of you may have heard of him, may have known him, he was not only, in fact, because Margaret Thatcher was much more conservative than the Church of England, which is the official church of the United Kingdom, she considered Rabbi Jacobowitz her spiritual leader much more than the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the way Lord Jacobowitz expressed it, if life is truly of infinite value, then infinity cannot be fractionated. Half of infinity is still infinity. So even if it's a second, 20 years, 100 years, it's of infinite value. Because once you start assessing life's value in relative terms, then you have compromised the value of life for every single person. Maybe Monday, my life was worthwhile. Tuesday, it wasn't. Wednesday, I wouldn't want a report card every single moment. So that's principle number three. So again, principle number one is Judaism is not Christian Science. We do believe in the utilization of medical technology. Principle number two, Pikuach Nefesh allows us to, and compels us, to violate the Torah to sustain life of any duration. And principle number three, which is really a corollary, perhaps it's not a distinct principle, is quality of life is not a factor in the midst of the prolonged life. But again, I'm going to qualify this, so keep that in abeyance. Principle number four. Those of you that are physicians and have some background in bioethics are undoubtedly familiar with what is called the Georgetown Mantra. They know the Kennedy Institute in D.C. here has one of the great centers of bioethics, medical ethics in the United States. And they formulated a number of years ago kind of four basic ideas of bioethics that even an undergraduate course in medical ethics are going to know. And this is called the Georgetown Mantra. And the four principles are beneficence, try to do good, non-maleficence, fancy word for do no harm. Principle number three is autonomy, respect the autonomy of the patient to make decisions. And principle number four are concerns for distributive justice, that you have to look at the overall system, whether resources are being allocated fairly or not. These are four basic principles. But I have to tell you that in the law as it has developed, there is one principle that overrides everything, and that is autonomy. Autonomy might be only one out of the four, but it is the dominant legal principle that governs. Patients have the right to go to hell if they want, meaning to say, if the patient wants it, the patient gets it, at least in the direction of, well, let me put it this way. If the patient doesn't want it, the patient doesn't get it. The patient may not be able to get what he wants aggressively, but if he doesn't want a medical treatment, that's the Cruzan case that Eddie cited earlier. And autonomy is the basic idea. My body belongs to me, and I do with it what I want. That's the underpinning of the abortion decision as well, although that ignores the fetus by definition. So let me just point out that from a Jewish perspective, the concept that I own my body is not entirely true. There was a classic essay written around 70 years ago describing Shylock, right? If you remember The Merchant of Venice, right? So Shylock is the Jewish moneylender in Shakespeare's play. And Shylock makes a deal with Antonio that if Antonio doesn't pay the loan in time, Antonio will, or Shylock will be able to take a pound of flesh. Right, that's entered the English language for driving a hard bargain is a pound of flesh, kind of medieval liposuction. And the interesting discussion that this rabbi, Rabbi Zevin, one of the great, great rabbis of the 20th century, discussed, if we analyze this halakhically, that I agree to give up a pound of flesh, or if I don't pay you, you can cut my finger, would this be a halakhically enforceable agreement? So Rabbi Zevin concluded, it would not be halakhically enforceable. You could not agree to mutilate yourself. But the reason he gives is a fascinating reason. He doesn't talk about it in terms of the ritual laws against self-endangerment, but he says a simple proposition. You cannot pledge your body as payment for your debt because your body is not your property. It is the property of God given to you for a loan. Now, the same way that I can't borrow money and then give you a mortgage on Bill Gates' house, if I could, my credit limit would be a lot higher. And the reason is because it's not my house. It's not my body. My body belongs to God. Now, because of this, this has a lot of repercussions. Again, and I admit that I myself am remiss. This is why a person should not do bungee jumping and dangerous activities. A person, even cosmetic surgery for vanity reasons, I don't mean for burn victims, is something that at least you have to ask a rabbi to discuss whether it's permitted. This is why we do have obligations. And again, I give much to myself, take better care of our health in terms of exercise and nutrition, because the notion that it's my body, I can do with it what I want, halacha rejects that. So consequently, based on all of this, based on these four factors, the endorsement of high-tech interventions, the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, the fact that even when quality is low or non-existent, life is of infinite value, and the limited role of autonomy in halacha, seems to indicate that, generally speaking, we have to be absolutely aggressive in keeping people alive under all circumstances. Okay, that's one side of the equation. However, as I indicated before, halacha is complicated. And this is not as cut and dried as you might assume. And that's why things get murky. There are indeed some rabbis who espouse what is called a vitalist position. A vitalist position literally means exactly the position I just sketched out. That because every second of life is of infinite value, we must aggressively and proactively keep people alive under every and all conceivable circumstances, even against the will of the patient, putting aside the legalities, of course. A doctor might lose his license if he violates patient autonomy. But from a strict halachic standpoint, the vitalist position, and the rabbi that espoused this most prominently is a great rabbi at Yeshiva University, Rabbi J. David, J is an initial, J. David Bleich, who has written extensively on Jewish medical ethics. And he basically says, no excuses, you've got to aggressively prolong life, whatever the cost. He only admits to two exceptions, which are important exceptions. And that is, Rabbi Bleich says, number one, you can pray for somebody's death if they are suffering. But I have to admit, to me, there seems to be a logical conundrum in which you're praying that God should take him out of his suffering, and you're doing everything you can to keep him in that situation. It's a little odd that you're praying for something that you're going exactly the opposite direction, but this is what Rabbi Bleich says, that you are allowed to pray that somebody should die. The second one is also very important, and that is the use of pain relief that potentially may shorten life. So for example, in something like morphine, there is the potential of cardiac arrest or death, etc. And Rabbi Bleich rules, and this is halacha rules, that pain relief is appropriate and permitted even if there's an incremental risk of death, as long as it is not intentionally being administered in a lethal dose. Now, only God knows, necessarily. Okay, that's one thing. But this is the halachic standard. In a sense, this mirrors a little bit. It's kind of close to what the Catholic Church calls the double effect standard, where your motivation is not to terminate life. Your motivation is to alleviate pain. It may have the effect of terminating life, but that is not prohibited because it is being administered for pain relief. But other than that, Rabbi Black's vitalist position basically says, keep people alive with CPR, keep people alive with chemotherapy. Person has terminal cancer, even with chemo, you can keep them alive for another week, you gotta do it. Now let me point out though that in a way, it's a little unfortunate. Rabbi Black is an enormously great scholar, and I have great, great respect for him. And he writes all of his stuff in English, so many, many people get the impression that Jewish law is what he says, because he's the one that writes all the stuff in English. But he buries a tremendous amount of information in footnotes. He states his position, and then he brings in footnotes all the different people that argue with him. And there are quite a few that argue with him. And in particular, I want to share with you the alternative views of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who are very, very great, who were very, very great rabbis. And their position is the following. They understand that yes, there's a great, great mitzvah to keep people alive, 100%. But they also understand there's a great mitzvah to alleviate pain, suffering. And therefore, one has to look at how do I fulfill these two commandments when they are going to be in conflict. Now, in the olden days, this conflict wasn't so acute. Because in the olden days, if we couldn't cure you, we also couldn't keep you alive that long. So we either helped you or we didn't help you, and you die relatively quickly. Today, with various forms of life support, life can be extended for a fairly long time, sometimes, but at the expense of suffering. Now, Baruch Hashem, as I indicated, it may be a false conflict because of advances in pain relief, so you might be able to prolong life and alleviate pain. But let's assume, just for hypothetical, you're in a situation where prolonging life keeps a person in pain. Rabbi Bleich says, sorry, that's a tragedy, but you gotta keep people alive. That's what Rabbi Bleich says. But Rav Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Orbach say the following. They do draw certain differentiations that you need to be aware of. They say the following. Under no circumstances is something called active euthanasia or assisted suicide ever permitted. That is a given. So to deliberately administer a lethal dose of a medication, through injection, through mouth, whatever it would be, that's beyond the pale. A halacha regards assisted suicide as murder, even if it's undertaken for laudatory, compassionate purposes. You can't engage in active mercy killing. But when the issue is not to actually kill a person, the issue is whether I should provide aggressive medical treatment that will prolong life or prolong the death process, as is sometimes described. Here, they are willing to say that if a patient's life duration is in any case short, meaning the underlying disease cannot be cured. The underlying illness cannot be cured. And life can be prolonged only for a relatively short duration, which is defined as 1 year based on various halachic texts. There is no obligation to prolong life if that will leave the patient with excruciating pain and suffering that cannot be properly alleviated. However, they differentiate between aggressive medical treatment and the supplying of hydration and nutrition, which are considered to be the normal processes that sustain life. Now, this is a bit complicated. Let me use a concrete example. Let's say you have a person that is suffering advanced pancreatic cancer. And although God can always do miracles, but generally speaking, the medical consensus is that the person is going to die in 6 months. And with chemotherapy, we can keep him alive for 8 months. So chemo will give him 2 months of life. The chemotherapy itself will be painful, and it will also keep him with the cancer that will be painful. Are we obligated to give a person chemotherapy to prolong his life by a few months? Now, Rabbi Bleich would say yes, but Rav Feinstein and Rav Auerbach would say, given the fact that in any event his life expectancy is less than a year, and the treatment itself will cause great pain and suffering, and the cancer itself causes great pain and suffering, we, meaning the patient, now the patient has the right to ask for the treatment. I'm not suggesting the patient can't get the treatment if he wants, but the patient is under no halachic obligation to prolong his pain and suffering in a non-curative way where the treatment itself will cause additional pain and suffering. Now, this analysis would also hold true for a lot of cases of do not resuscitate, DNRs, or don't use chest compression or the like. Typically, when people are in advanced end stage, even if you do some chest resuscitation or whatever it is, it will only keep the person alive for a very short time. And the procedure itself can cause pain. You can break a rib, puncture a lung, particularly in the elderly. So halacha might validate the utilization of a DNR, which is passively withholding a medical intervention when there is no reasonable process or prospects of recovery and the patient is suffering great suffering and the like. Now, please let me emphasize here that this is not based on diminished quality of life. An Alzheimer's patient may have a severely diminished quality of life, but if there is no pain or suffering, you have to be very aggressive in keeping people alive. Do not confuse this. This is not a quality of life test. This is an excruciating pain or suffering standard, which is quite different. And this may lead to what you might regard as a counterintuitive idea, that paradoxically, when people are in comas, you have to treat them quite aggressively, precisely because they're not feeling, so we think, they're not experiencing pain or suffering. You see? So the right of the conscious patient to decline chemotherapy might not translate to the right of the unconscious patient to decline, because in the absence of pain and suffering, the imperative of sustaining life, no matter what its quality, is going to be in full force. Now, I just want to point out that these are very, very complicated questions. Let me give you two reasons why. On one hand, we are distinguishing between active euthanasia, which is always prohibited, versus passively not intervening to keep people alive, which may be permitted in cases of extreme pain and suffering. But the distinction of what is active and what is passive is in itself not always clear. For example, if a patient is not yet on a respirator, my decision to put him on a respirator is an active decision, so if I don't do so, that's passive. What if they're on the respirator and I'm shutting it off? Right? Is that passive vis-a-vis not giving him future breathing support? Or is that active because he's already on the system? Right? Difficult question. Moreover, even for passive, the justification is only pain and suffering, right? If without pain and suffering, you got to keep people alive. Well, what does pain and suffering mean? What if somebody's a quadriplegic? In a neurological sense, they may not have any pain. You could take a needle and jab them with the needle. There's no pain in the narrow physiological definition of pain, but there is psychic pain, right? Despondency, depression, sadness. Is halacha, again, I'm not answering questions, I'm raising them. Is halacha concerned exclusively with the physical phenomenon of pain? I'll give you an example. In the legal system, there's a term called pain and suffering. And some commentators have actually said that they are different. Pain refers to the physiological sensation of jabbing a needle into my hand. Suffering refers to the psychological sense of internal devastation. Well, halacha doesn't have that pairing. Halacha just talks about tsar. The halachic word for pain is tsar. Tsar. But there's an ambiguity in that term. Does tsar correspond to the physical idea? So the quadriplegic would have to be kept alive? Or does tsar embrace the psychic devastation? Again, one needs to talk to rabbis about this, people. And again, this is a rabbinic specialty. I don't mean to even suggest that every rabbi would be capable of addressing these issues. And let me point out, too, that this is a very good illustration in the halachic process of a phenomenon that could be called garbage in, garbage out, meaning to say the following. A rabbi might know all of the halachot, but the rabbi's decision will only be as good as the factual input that the rabbi receives. And if the rabbi does not know the medical facts on the ground, if the rabbi does not know the diagnosis and the side effects and the total situation, he may be the most learned rabbi in the world, but his halachic decision is not going to be correct because it is predicated on erroneous factual assumptions. And that is why, for those of you that are halachically committed, Jewishly committed physicians, it's pretty important both for you and for the rabbis who are consulted to have a partnership and a collaboration, because we need you folks to give us the information upon which we can make the halachic judgments that need to be made. Yeah. Yes.
Suppose you have a 95-year-old woman. She's not in pain, and there's no suffering, but she goes into cardiac arrest. Are you obligated to prolong her life, to get her kidneys are failing?
Yeah.
You have to do dialysis.
So let's differentiate that. There is a halachic basis that you're not obligated to do CPR. I apologize. Yeah. The question that was asked is an actual situation. A 95-year-old woman who is doing okay, she's not suffering, but she goes into cardiac arrest. Is there a halachic obligation to do CPR in order to restore her heartbeat, her breathing, and the like? All right, that was the question. So what I would answer to is the following. Even though she is not presently, or she was not presently undergoing pain and suffering, the CPR process itself is going to inflict pain and suffering. The bones of the elderly are fragile. They may break. There may be a puncture of a lung. So based on the idea that CPR in the elderly, in any case, generally only prolongs life for a relatively short period, you are not obligated to engage in treatments that are painful and destructive to prolong life for a short time. So I would, yes, I would say that there is no halakhic obligation. Now, dialysis is a bit more complicated, because dialysis might, in theory, be a way to keep her alive without necessarily creating pain. But on the other hand, this will get us into the problem of psychic pain, because the dialysis of being confined, you know, depending on how it works, but you might have to be confined in a small place for hours a day, etc. So that would be a much more difficult question. I think halacha might require attempting to dialysize, but it would not require chest compression or CPR.
Is there ever a time when you take into account the pain or suffering of family versus the patient?
Yeah, you know, this is a very, very excellent question. And I have to say, and again, I am not at all insensitive to the toll that Alzheimer's and other illnesses, end-of-life decisions, can take on a family. But I have to say that halakhically, at least, it's not relevant. There is a responsibility on the Jewish community to help families as units over this, including giving the caregivers time off to pursue their own life and get away from it all, and that's part of our obligation. But once again, every life has to be judged on its own standards, and one cannot make these decisions based on the fact that it's difficult for me. And as I say, there is an obligation for us to help caregivers. Caregivers need caregivers as well. But, you know, as I say, you can't allow compromising a right to life based on that. Yes? Yes?
I actually have a question from the physician. I'm a critical care physician.
Yeah.
And the question that had come up relatively recently, and it was actually during H1N1 epidemic in 2009,
yeah,
where the concept of mass critical care had come to play. And obviously the plan of mass casualties and how modern critical care would address mass casualties,
yeah,
in the setting of limited resources.
Yes, yes.
I appreciate,
yeah,
your comments,
yes,
in terms of,
yes,
eclectic approach. When you have 20,
yeah,
let's say 25 years old, a group of school, let's say college children coming to the emergency department of a certain hospital that has 14 ICU beds, and we have, let's say we have 20 available ventilators, so 14 are taken, 6 are available, 25 college students arrive in the emergency department, and out of 14 beds in the intensive care unit, we have, let's say, 5 patients who are already known to be terminally ill,
yeah,
with poor full code, and therefore the withdrawal of support is not an option.
Yeah, this is very, very excellent. Again, it's obvious that my whole presentation was simply based on what you call bedside ethics. I'm the doctor, he's the patient, and this is the only person in the world, and I gotta deal with him. In reality, of course, when you have mass casualties, limited resources, there's a whole different set of principles that comes into play, whether you call it triage or whether you call it allocation of scarce resources. And it comes up over and over again. Limited hospital beds, limited organs, limited dialysis machines. Who do you prioritize? And it's interesting, the Mishnah itself discusses this in the context of, I'm walking by a river and two people are drowning, which person do I save, which is really an early example of a triage type of problem. The answer the Mishnah gives is a bit of a surprising answer, and we don't really apply it today for various reasons. The Kohen is saved before the Levi, and the Levi, etc. So, you know, two people are drowning. Said, are you a Kohen? Yeah. Okay. Whatever it would be. But putting that aside, the operational principle that generally applies is that once the resource has been assigned, it cannot be removed, even to somebody more meritorious. So even if a terminally ill person has a dialysis machine, you cannot take it away and give it to a healthy person who has a better chance of survival. However, in the initial allocation decision, you can assign the resource to where it will do the most good. So halakha does permit a sense of who has the best chance of survival for the longest period. Now, this may be somewhat surprising, because let's consider two candidates. Just 30 seconds, I'll be finished. Two candidates. One is the greatest rabbi and tzaddik of the world, who is 85 years old and not very healthy. And the other is some teenage bum who happens to be healthy because he hasn't ruined himself with drugs yet. If you haven't yet allocated the machine, you give it to the kid. Again, that's a little counterintuitive, but halacha basically says that until a resource is allocated, it is allocated to where it will prolong the most life. So triage, by definition, forces you to make those choices. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Breidowitz. Thank you so much.